some of the halachos that govern pikuach nefesh on Shabbos. That really was just scratching the surface. I'm beginning the sugya, which is a very complicated one, a very important one. And in this class, I hope that we're not going to go into all the details of Hilchos Shabbos in their minutia. I was told that Rabbi Willig gave a class last year. Anybody here was in his class? Apparently he did bishul for the entire semester. So there's a lot to talk about, obviously, on every one of the malachos of Shabbos, but we're going to try to really have a survey or an overview of some of the different areas and topics that govern Hilchos Shabbos. So what I wanted to go on to now was Pikuach Nefesh was the discussion last week, but what I want to talk about this afternoon is something that is, I guess, a hypersensitive topic, a very delicate issue, somewhat volatile, I guess, you can say. But what's important in this discussion is to stick it out until the end. Because if you cut out at any point in the middle, you're going to walk away with a very mistaken impression of the halacha, probably of the religion. And it's important that we discuss it, but just to understand that we need to have a full perspective in order to gain really an appreciation for what the halacha is. And the topic that we're going to discuss is, last week we talked about pikuach nefesh on Shabbos. What we need to talk about today is, does that go across the board? Is that something that is equal for Jews and non-Jews alike? Is that something that we would say Shabbos should be violated to save anyone's life? Or do you say perhaps that is limited? Again, you understand why it's a sensitive issue. You understand why it's very, very complicated, but also very important. It comes up in the Gemara, comes up in Shulchan Aruch, and it's something we need to discuss. And specifically, any students here who are planning on going to med school? Yeah? So it's specifically a very important issue there, because when we talk about rotations for getting med school, when one becomes a doctor and you have to figure out rotations on Shabbos, is that something that is permissible? Is it something that is not? This is a very, very relevant topic and very important. So by way of introduction, we spoke last week about pikuach nefesh on Shabbos is something that we're supposed to get involved and do whatever we can to save a life. However, the Gemara said it doesn't stop there. The Gemara says even for a suffik pikuach nefesh, even when I am not sure whether or not this is something that can lead to a dangerous situation, I would tell someone to be mechala Shabbos to take care of that as well. Now, let's say you change the case. Suffik pikuach nefesh, generally, we would probably assume that that means when someone has a situation when they're not sure whether or not this is life-threatening, so we err on the side of caution and we say, you should save a life. What if we have, the Gemara here gives a case in Maseches Yuma Daf Pei Gimel. An unusual case, but it happens unfortunately every so often. So the Gemara here talks about the following case. What happens when I have a situation of Nafla Alav Mapolis? What happens when you have a building collapses? So it's not often that we're confronted with such a situation. But let's say the last time that I remember such a thing was in Surfside. So you had this horrifying scene, a building collapsed, and now you don't know where the people are, how to get to them. You have obviously a limited amount of time until the person just dies from starvation or from lack of food or drinks or hydration or anything like that. So you have a limited amount of time. You're trying to do the best job that you can. And what should one do? What should one do? Now, let me just change the case away from Shabbos for a moment. Say, for example, you have that building, that horrifying, horrific scene. And when you're dealing with that, you have two options. You can start picking away at one brick at a time, taking it off, moving it off to the side. You'll never save anyone's life, unfortunately, because if you do it that way, there's only a limit to how many bricks you can take away from an entire building. So what is the more effective way to do it? You come in with, I don't know if a tractor is the right word, but you come in with some kind of real equipment, and you have to start moving things aside in order to get to the people that are on the bottom. Now, as a result of what you're doing, it's quite obvious that you're going to have to, unfortunately, kill someone who's on the top, because they're going to get crushed by whatever equipment you're going to bring into the scene. So do I have a right to do that? To potentially kill somebody who's at the top in order to save the multitudes that are at the bottom? That's the question. So some might say, when you're faced with a dilemma, better is sheva al tasir, which means it's better to remain passive than to actively kill someone. So maybe the better choice, I'm sorry that I'm talking about such a graphic scene, but maybe, in theory, it would be better just to leave things as they are, don't get involved, and let the chips fall however they do. If people are saved, great. If people die, unfortunately, it's a terrible outcome. However, what was I supposed to do? Were I to come in with a machine that would help me get to the people who are on the bottom, I very potentially may kill someone who's on the top. Is that the right choice to be made? Do we say that when you're faced with a major dilemma like this one, Rachmana Litzlan, God forbid, is the answer that perhaps I should just shave al taseh? And this is a very important question that has many, many different applications in halacha. So the Gemara Maseches Erevin has the following story. And to us, it's a little bit remote because we're not so familiar with karbanos today. But the Gemara does say that there were some karbanos that had to be sprinkled on the Mizbeach four times, some karbanos that had to be sprinkled on the Mizbeach one time. So, if it was this kind of blood from this kind of carbon, you sprinkle it once. That kind of blood from that kind of carbon, you sprinkle four times. The Gemara says, what happens if I have a bowl of blood from a carbon that has to be sprinkled four times that gets mixed up with one that has to be sprinkled one? What should I do? What do I do now? So, again, it's a case that never comes up today because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we don't have karbanos, but in theory, what should I do? And the Gemara gets into a discussion. Is it better to do more? Is it better to do less? Should I just sprinkle both of them once and err on the side of caution? Or do you say no? Sprinkle both of them four times. Well, is it better to actively do something wrong or to passively leave out that which I'm not supposed to do? That's part of the Gemara's discussion there, and that's a very important discussion that has far-reaching consequences. So, for example, there was a great king by the name of Chizkiyahu HaMelech. And at the time, there was a great threat to the entire Beis HaMikdash being destroyed. Chizkiyahu HaMelech understood that that was something that he would never let happen under his leadership if it was an option in his mind. And Chizkiyahu HaMelech decided he was going to negotiate with the enemy. Now, how do you negotiate with the enemy when they're trying to destroy a Beis HaMikdash and you will do everything to stop it? How do you stop it other than waging war, which he was not prepared to do? So the Psukim in Sefer Melachim tell us, Chizkiyahu HaMelech decided to cut off the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, cut off the doorways of the Beis HaMikdash, and give it as a gift to the enemy. Now these were obviously very expensive doors, and he assumed that by doing so he was going to then be able to negotiate them down. But how could he do that? How can you actively defile a part of the Beis HaMikdash when you know that you're doing something wrong? Now, obviously, you have an ulterior motive. Obviously, the ulterior motive is very pure and it's wonderful. But is that something that is allowed or perhaps not? That is a discussion in Sefer Melachim. And we find that Chizkiyahu HaMelech was praised for what he did. And what you see from that is that sometimes actively doing something that seems to be wrong is not the improper choice. Sometimes it is the right thing to do because it's what we refer to in halacha as being bocher b'miut hara. You have to size up the situation and you have to figure out what is going to bring about the lesser of the two evils. Both options that I'm faced with are terrible options. Both outcomes are terrible outcomes. But what should my response be? Should I just be passive? Or do you say no? Sometimes being active is better because there will be lesser of a negative outcome as a result of what I'm doing. So for example, the Shulchan Aruch quotes a Gemara Maseches Brachos. What happens if I have a situation where somebody's traveling and there are all kinds of bandits on the road and you're afraid that they're going to come and they're going to steal something very valuable that's in your suitcase? So the Gemara says, what should I do? I'm concerned that I have a pair of tefillin, I have a mezuzah, and I know that if they find that, immediately they're going to destroy it. They're going to take it out of the suitcase, they're going to defile it. So the Gemara says, I should sit on the mezuzah. I should sit on the pair of tefillin. I should sit on a sefer Torah, in order that I should be able to save it from being taken by somebody who I would meet on the street, somebody who might come and steal it from me and then defile it. It's better that I sit on a sefer Torah as I'm traveling than to allow the sefer Torah to be subject to the enemies getting their hands on it. Which is a fascinating psak, but that is what the Shulchan Aruch says. And based on that, there are achronim who say, the Shavus Yaakov writes, that if I'm afraid that a shul is about to be destroyed and the svarim are going to be taken by the enemy and they're going to defile them, Shavus Yaakov writes, you're allowed to be soreif sifrei hakodesh. You'd be allowed to burn sifrei kodesh. I don't know how many of you remember the hitnatkut in Gush Katif. Right, it was probably, you were very young, I assume. How long ago was that? think it was the year 2000, if I'm mistaken. I don't know, someone could look it up. When the disengagement happened from Gaza in recent modern history. So it was a very, very tragic story. And it was a terrible time. And sometimes, if you just read the news, you get the picture, like we're talking about these wild extremists who lived in all these communities. It's not the case. These were built-up communities. They had yeshivas, they had schools, they had mikvahs, they had homes, they had children, they had everything. Full functioning communities that were completely uprooted from where they lived, and their towns were destroyed, their parnasa was destroyed, everything. So as it came closer to the disengagement, the week that it happened, I happened to be in Eretz Yisrael with my parents, and my father was invited to come and visit this one of the communities, many of the communities there. And I remember at the time we went from one home to another, giving chizuk, talking to them. My father gave shiurim all over the place. And at one point, a Rosh Hashiva came over to my father and he said, Rav Shechter Avishai, I built this community from the ground up. I came here with 10 families 25 years ago. I built the whole place. There was nothing here. It was a wasteland. I then built a yeshiva. Then the boys got married from the yeshiva and they all moved back here. And they're raising their families with children in this community. And we've all built homes and we're doing very well. In another 3 days, it seems that my entire life's work is about to go up in smoke. It seems to me like the Israeli government is going to go ahead with the plan and destroy our community and disengage from this community and make us leave, make us relocate. So he wanted to know, if that should happen, do I have a right to go into the yeshiva that I built with my own two hands, this beautiful yeshiva, beautiful Beis Medrash, beautiful Beis HaKnesses, do I have a right to go into the yeshiva and firebomb it before we leave? Because I know what's going to happen. I know that if I don't, this is going to turn into a mosque. So what's better? Is it better that I actively destroy a shul? Firebomb a shul? Or is it better to leave it for the enemy to do whatever they want with? And whatever ends up happening will happen. That is a terrifying shaila. But it's something that unfortunately was asked many, many times over Jewish history. I remember when I was in the White Shul in Far Rockaway, so there was an elderly gentleman. The minig in the White Shul was, I've never seen this anywhere else, Shabbos afternoon when they do Kriyas HaTorah by Mincha, they take out the Sefer Torah and they remove all the gold and silver crowns on the Sefer Torah. Only by Shabbos Mincha. I never understood what it was about. I always thought, very naively, that Shabbos morning is like the important time in Shul because like everybody's there and it's very full. So we want to like show off the Sefer Torah with all the gold and silver. And then like Shabbos Mincha is like, okay, you know, whatever. Obviously, that was not the reason why they did it, but I never really understood it. So they told me the reason why they do this is because Moshe Rabbeinu died on Shabbos afternoon, as Chazal tell us. And we're supposed to show that we're in some sort of avelus over the loss of Moshe Rabbeinu, over his death. And therefore, we take away the crown on the Sefer Torah almost to show symbolically that it's as if our crown, Moshe Rabbeinu, has been taken away from us. Okay, that's what the minute comes from. That's what it's all about. Anyway, there was a man in the shul, an elderly gentleman, who every single Shabbos, without fail, when they went to the Aron Kodesh to take out the Sefer Torah, he would stand there and cry. Every week. Finally, I got myself together and I asked him, what are you so emotional about every single Shabbos when they take the Sefer Torah out of the Aron? You start crying. Only by Mincha. He said, listen, I'm a Holocaust survivor. I was 16 years old when the Nazis came and invaded the town. 2 days before it happened, we knew it was happening. And the Rav of the city came over to me and he said, I'm concerned. We have gold and silver on the Sifri Torah. And if we leave it here, you know what's going to happen. The enemy's going to take it and use it for terrible things. So the rabbi of the town came over to me and he asked that me and my brother should go out into the forest, take all the gold and silver and melt it into the ground. He said, I want you to know, from that day, I have not went one day in my life without thinking about what I did. And I feel so horrible, I feel so guilty that I defiled the property of the Sifri Torah, the property of the shul. So it was very moving. And obviously it's not the time or appropriate place to get into it with him. Oh, was he right? Was he wrong? It's not the point. But if we take a perspective objectively and ask ourselves, so was he right or was he wrong? The answer is he's absolutely right. Because sometimes that's what we need to do. Even if actively it seems that we're doing something wrong, in the end of the day, if it's going to be lesser of the two evils, then that is what we choose and that is what we do. So there's a psak in the Ramah and Shulchan Aruch where the Ramah says, if you have a unaffiliated Jew that comes to your home and wants a drink, so the Ramah says, you're not allowed to give someone a drink if you know they're not going to make a bracha on it. That's what the Ramah says. That would be a violation of Lifnei Iver Lo Sitei Michsho. You're giving the person a drink, but you know they're not going to make a bracha, so how can you do such a thing? That's what he says. So, the story happened that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had someone who came to Yerushalayim for a building dedication of a yeshiva. And at some point, like any person would, Rav Shlomo Zalman invited this person into the yeshiva, and he said, please come inside to my office, I'm going to give you a drink, it's a sweltering hot day outside. I don't expect you to stand outside and have nothing to do and nothing to drink. So he invites him in, gives him what to drink. They talk, they're sitting, they're eating, whatever they're doing, and then they go back outside to whatever was supposed to be happening there. Okay. The Talmidim came to Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and they said, don't you know the Ramah says you're not allowed to offer a drink to someone who you know is not going to make a bracha? So, how is it that you did that? Shlomo Zalman was so upset that they had this question. He ended up writing a tshuva to explain his position. And he writes in the beginning of the tshuva that he's embarrassed to even be writing this because it's so obvious. So let's read his words together. Here are number vav. How we got to number vav, I don't know. But we're up to number vav. So if you look at number vav, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says the following. Hareza dome. This is similar, he writes. Lemi shekotea etzva meraglo shel chavero. Let's say you have a doctor. Somebody comes into the doctor's office and they have a major infection in one of their legs. The doctor says to them, listen, we're going to have to amputate. It's a terrible thing. But the problem is, if we don't amputate, the infection is going to spread and it's going to kill you. It's going to spread to other parts of your body. And then your entire body will be infected and you're going to have nothing to do then. You're going to die. So obviously, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, that doctor is going to do what he or she has to do, and they're going to do an amputation, as terrible as it is to ever have to tell a patient that and to ever have to do that procedure. So says Rav Shlomo Zalman. Let's read it together. Hareza Doma, this is similar. The Misha Kotea Etzbo Meiranglo Shachadero, Bechde Lahatsilo So Bekach Mitias Kalayachelo. Imagine if they cut off one limb in the hopes that they're going to be able to save the rest of the body. Pashadhu, says Rav Shlomo Zalman, how would you categorize that person? How would you classify that doctor? Would you say he is a mazik? Or would you say he's a matzil? Would you say he's wonderful, he saved a life? Or would you say, no, he destroyed a life? What do you mean? The person used to have two legs and now he only has one. How would you look at that individual? So Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach writes, it's obvious. Mitzvah hu dekavid v'lo avera. It's clear that, of course, he's doing the right thing. Because obviously he's saving a life. Kach gam kan, so too over here, he says, eino choshev himachshil. When I had this person, had I not offered for that individual to come into my room and have a drink, what would have the outcome been? He would have hated religious Jews forever. He would have said, how insensitive can they be? What a lack of thoughtfulness. What a lack of caring. Look at these people. Here I am, sweltering heat in the middle of Yerushalayim in the summer. Nobody could offer me a drink. Now he doesn't know the reason why we didn't offer drinks, because one's going to make a bracha. But he's looking from his perspective and he says, this is crazy, how can this be? And therefore, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, sometimes you have to look at the entire picture and then draw a conclusion. The entire picture here was that if I didn't give him a drink, it would be far worse of an outcome than by giving him a drink where he doesn't make a bracha. So, that in general is a very, very important shaila. Again, it comes up all over the place and it's very relevant lahalacha. But it's something that we need to think about. Whenever we have a suffix, is the answer just sheva al tasa? Is the answer don't do anything? Or do you say sometimes not doing anything is worse than perhaps doing something that could potentially save the situation from being worse than it is? So let's go back to the original Gemara. The Gemara can be found here in number Aleph. It's a Gemara Maseches Yuma, Pei Gimel Amud Aleph. Misha Nafla Alav Mapolis. So let's say you have somebody who is in an unfortunate position where an avalanche falls upon them. And now, Safik Husham, Safik Enosham. It's great pandemonium all over the place. Everyone's running. Nobody knows, is there actually a human being who's stuck under there or not? We don't even know. We thought we saw a hiker there. We thought we saw somebody before, but we're not even sure whether there's anyone there. Safik Chai, Safik Mace. Even if there is somebody who we know with certainty was here before and is certainly stuck in this rubble, we're not sure if the person has already died. So we have question number one is there someone here? Question number two is, even if there is someone here, is that person even alive? Number three, Safik Kusi, Safik Yisrael. We're not sure, is this individual a Jew? Or is this individual a non-Jew? Says the Gemara, if this situation happens on Shabbos, Mifakhin alav eshagal. Even though we know that rocks are muksa on Shabbos, and even though we know it's going to entail a malacha, you're allowed to uncover as much as you can to try to find any remains of any people that are there. I shouldn't say remains. To find any people that you think may still be alive, you're allowed to go and uncover and do everything in order to potentially save a life. Even though we're not sure if anyone's there, we're not sure if the person is alive or dead, and we're not sure if the person is even a Jew. That's the Gemara. Now, what's the implication of the Gemara in terms of our discussion? What do you see from here? What do you see from here? In terms of the Shaila of saving the life of a non-Jew on Shabbos, can you prove anything from here? Yeah. So your takeaway is there's no difference between a Jew and a non-Jew. Anyone else have a different takeaway?
I feel like there's
something. Oh. So I would have said, you see from the Gemara that the takeaway is, doesn't matter if it's a Jew or a non-Jew, we have to save a life. No, let's read the Gemara carefully. What does the Gemara say? The only reason I'm allowed to do it is because it's a Safek Kusi, Safek Yisrael. It seems from the Gemara that the only allowance that I have to be Mechal Shabbos is because maybe it's a Jew, maybe it's a non-Jew. And because I'm not sure, therefore I'm allowed to do it. What if I knew with certainty that it was not a Jew? What if I saw the people beforehand and I know that they're just not Jewish? They're not part of the Jewish community. As much as I love them and as much as I respect them, the Gemara says, it seems that you would not be allowed to violate Shabbos to save their life. Again, I ask you, please hang in there till the end of the shir so that we can tie up all the loose ends. But if you read the Gemara, it's clear that this is what the Gemara says. Safik Kusi, Safik Yisrael, the only reason why I have a heter, why I have an allowance to save this person's life or potentially save their life, is because I think that maybe there's a Jew stuck underneath. If I knew with certainty there was not a single Jew there, it seems in the Gemara I would not be allowed to do it. Let's read another Gemara. That certainly is the primary source. We're going to go through another very important Gemara in this discussion, which is the Gemara Maseches Avodah Zarah, Taf Chav Vav Amud Aleph. Turn to the second side, number Ches. So the Gemara says as follows. This is not talking about Shabbos. This is talking about during the week. Bas Yisrael lo tiyaled eso obedes kochavim. So you said you want to go to medical school. What kind of medicine do you want to go into? You're not sure. Gynecologist? Obstetrics? Okay, so that's a very exciting field. Right, your father's. It's a very exciting field. And the question is, do you think that every gynecologist only has Jewish patients? Every Jewish gynecologist only has Jewish patients? Why would they? They have patients that want to use them. Whether the Jews or not Jews is not part of the application process. So says the Gemara here. Let's say you are somebody who knows how to be a midwife, or you know how to deliver babies because you're a doctor. Bas Yisrael lo tiyaled esel vedos kochavim. Shocking statement. The Gemara says, if I have a non-Jewish woman that comes and asks, can you please deliver my child? The Gemara says, no. Why? Because you're bringing another Oved Avodah Zarah into the world. Amazing. That's what the Gemara says. Now, Rabbi Kibega writes, it's only if you're a real Oved Avodah Zarah. Now, what does a real Oved Avodah Zarah actually mean? Good question. What does a real Oved Avodah Zarah actually mean? So you ever been? I spoke in Roslyn the other day. Who's from Roslyn? In the next class? I spoke in Roslyn the other day. Somebody drove me. And on my way, as we were pulling up, right across the street from the shul, it was amazing. We saw somebody outside literally serving up a dessert. Never seen it in my life. It was amazing. They actually had a pot outside where they were smoking the incense for the Avodah Zarah. It was like an amazing scene. I said, just hold on a minute, I gotta watch this. So I came a couple minutes late to the shir because I was so amazed by what I watched. But it's not often that you have somebody who's actually an Ovid Avodah Zarah. Right? There's a whole question about Christianity for a non-Jew who's not considered Avodah Zarah. In the end, it's really called Shituf, which means they believe in God plus others. Now, obviously, a Jew is not allowed to believe in anyone else but HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but what's the halacha for a non-Jew? Is that considered Avodah Zarah or not for Christians to believe in Christianity? A whole question, not for now, maybe for another time, but here, Rabbi Akiva Eiger writes, when the Gemara says that you're not allowed to deliver a baby of an Avodah Zarah, it means someone who's a bona fide Ovid Avodah Zarah. So somebody called me with a shayla. I forgot exactly who it was, but at the time somebody had called me that they had a co-worker who actually went to visit her family in India, and she came back, she's a Buddhist, and she said there they actually serve Avodah Zarah. And she came back so sweet, and she said, you know, you're a religious colleague of mine, and I really, like, I appreciate the fact that you're religious, I'm religious, and we understand each other, and sometimes we have different customs than everybody else in the office, obviously not the same, but we have different customs than most of the other people here. And she said, I just decided to bring a gift back for you. What did she bring? Two little Buddhas back for him to put on his desk. The guy called me, and he said, what am I supposed to do? I'm like, that's Mamish Avodah Zarah. Look at this. This is like really a thing that they bow down to, and now it's on your desk. So that's unusual. You don't often have that situation. And then you have the mitzvah. I told him, this is very rare that you have the mitzvah of bir Avodah Zarah, of destroying an Avodah Zarah. It's not so often. You can't just walk into a passive worship of another religion and start destroying whatever they have. But if it belongs to you, you better destroy it. So that was a very rare and opportune mitzvah for this individual to do that. Be it as it may, the Gemara here says, you should not assist in the burning of Ovedes Kochavim because you are now bringing another Oved Avodah Zarah into the world. Okay, we're a minute. Ask the Gemara. This does not seem to be correct because we are told in another source, Yehudis mi'aledes Ovedes Kochavim mishar avalo b'chinam. We are told if I'm a doctor and I get paid for my services because I charge all of my patients or insurance pays me, I'm allowed to charge money to be the one who delivers a non-Jew. So what's the difference? So the Gemara says, Amar Rav Yosef b'schar shari mishum eva. There's a big difference here. Says the Gemara, if I'm a doctor and I'm seeing all kinds of patients and I get paid for my work, what's going to happen when a non-Jewish patient walks in and says, I'd like to pay you because I'd like to be patient like everybody else? What am I supposed to say? What should I say? I'm sorry, I'm not willing to accept you. Why are you not willing to accept me? I'm a wonderful person. I'm a great patient. I'm not going to give you a hard time. I'm just like everybody else. And as a result of that, it's going to lead to a situation of Eva. What's Eva? There's going to be tremendous animosity between the Jewish community and the non-Jews that they live with. Because, what are you going to say? I can't come to a hospital. I can't come to a doctor. Why am I less than anyone else? And therefore the Gemara says, Mishum Eva. Certainly the doctor would be allowed to take any patient. He's allowed to do anything. However, if you're talking about Mishum Chiya, if somebody just happens to be a retired midwife, and people knock on the door every so often when there's a complication and they say, oh, can you help us? Can you this? Can you that? So there the Gemara says, if all you're doing is favors for people, you're not charging, then it would make sense that you should not offer your services to an Ovedes Kochavim. Okay, that's what the Gemara says. So far so good? Any questions? No? Okay, then Rabbi Yosef ends off and he says,
Rabbi,
yeah,
question.
Sure.
If it's at the time of, if they don't pay him, and it's a friend, or if it's the time of like dire means that they need something, you're just not allowed to.
Right, so that's what I'm asking. Just hang on to the question till we round this out. If we just stop here, we're in big trouble, correct? Because how can it be? It's kind of what I think about when, you know, we have a mitzvah, Timcha Zecher Amalek. Timcha Zechar Amalek is a very difficult mitzvah. It's difficult because Jews don't like to kill people. I mean, lots of people in the world don't like to kill people. Most people that I know, Jews and non-Jews, are good, upstanding people. They're not violent. And yet HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells us, Timcha Zechar Amalek. So who is Amalek? So some people believe Amalek is some nation somewhere that God is going to identify to us at some point. Who Amalek is, we have to all go and destroy them. It's not so clear that that's the case. So what's going to happen? Let's say Amalek is not a nation who lives somewhere. Let's say Amalek was a nation from thousands of years ago, and now their descendants are all over. So I have a next door neighbor, or I have the mailman who's been delivering my mail for the last 15 years. Or I have a doctor who saved my life and did a life-saving surgery or procedure on me. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to me one day and says, by the way, your doctor, your next door neighbor, your mailman, is actually a descendant from Amalek. I'm sorry, but you're going to have to go kill him. How do we wrap our heads around that? Has this never bothered anyone? No one ever thought about it? It's fine. Like, things like this actually keep me up at night. Like, I just don't understand. Like, how's that going to work? What's going to happen? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to do it. And obviously, it's much easier to do the mitzvah of shaking lulav or blowing the shofar. What am I going to do when I'm expected to kill somebody who's my best friend and neighbor for the last 25 years, lives on my block? We're in and out of each other's homes. We raise our children together. What do I do then? So if you think I'm an apikoros, you have every good right to feel that way. And I, you know, this would never be something that I would say publicly, because it's a dangerous comment to make. But I was concerned about some thoughts like this. And at some point, Rav Asher Weiss told me that he wonders the same thing. He actually told me this when his wife was in Sloan Kettering and she was going in for a procedure. And I was there with them in the hospital. And it so happened that the doctor who was caring for them was, I think he was a Hindu or something, I don't remember. And he was talking religion, oh, you're a rabbi, very nice. And started getting a whole conversation. So they were talking. And he turned to me after, he said, this doctor just gave my wife a couple of more years of life. He saved her life. So what happens if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to turn to me someday and say, by the way, that doctor is a descendant of Amalek, I'm sorry to tell you, and I know how much you appreciate him. Like, what are we going to do? So this was a discussion we had. And here, the Gemara talks about something which makes us in contemporary society very uncomfortable. Now, it's what the Gemara says, and that's why I want to go through the sources, and I hope that you don't leave me before we're done, as I said, because it's important to go through it till the end. So now, Tosis there asks a very obvious question. Let's look in upper text. Tosis says, I don't understand. You're telling me that because there's a concern of Eva, because there's a concern that the non-Jew is going to be upset and there's going to be an animosity that will build between the Jew and the non-Jew, so therefore we're allowed to violate Shabbos? Therefore we can do whatever we want? Is that how this works? Tosis says, is that really the case? And Tosis comes to the conclusion, no, it's not the case. The only reason why we allow Mishum Eva is because it's not really a malacha to help deliver a baby. What are you doing? What malacha is there? Obviously, if you're going to turn the lights on and do all kinds of procedures, it's one thing. But if all I'm doing is capturing the baby and helping the woman feel good, there's no real malacha. And Tosa says, and therefore, if that's all you're doing, then obviously, Mishum Eva, you should get involved. But Tosa comes to the conclusion, if we're talking about a real malacha on Shabbos, you would not be allowed to do it, even though there's going to be a result of Eva. And based on that, the Mishnah Berurah writes very clearly. The Mishnah Berurah says that in his opinion, he was very against the doctors who allow themselves to go, and the way he says it is, they travel kama parsos lerefuas akum. You have a doctor who will travel in his car to go tend to a non-Jewish patient. The kosin, and they write on Shabbos all kinds of prescriptions, and they're going to do all kinds of malachos, and he says, ein lahem amashi yismochu. Says the Mishnah Berurah, they have nothing to rely on. How could a doctor get in his car and go tend to his patient on Shabbos who's not a Jew? How can you violate Shabbos? Look what the Gemara says. And Tosis comes to the conclusion that even though the Gemara says there's a consideration of Mishum Eva, which is very important, but Tosis says, that doesn't just allow us to do anything. The only reason why this was permissible is because it's not really a malacha. So I ask you, any of your parents doctors? You ever saw them go on a call on Shabbos? Do you think they only tended to a Jewish patient? Of course not. So how can this be? You look at the Gemara through the Rishonim, even as late and as recent as the Mishnah Berurah. which was not that long ago. The Shabru died in the 1930s, the Chafetz Chaim. Actually, today is his yard site. So, how do you understand how it is that Frum doctors all over the world, who are wonderful Yirei Shamayim and Shomrei Shabbos, somehow seem to get around us? So this is a very important question that is raised by the Chasam Sofer and many others subsequently as well. Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Shmira Shabbos Kol Chasa, and they all write as follows. They all say that obviously the circumstances have changed. We no longer live in shtetl communities like we did back in Europe. When we lived in our own shtetl and we had our own community and we didn't get involved with anyone else, you know, my father has commented to me, sometimes you find that there are some Jews who claim to be very ultra-Orthodox, very religious in so many other areas, and yet they have no problem cheating the government. So why is that? They're not evil people. I mean, some are. So they cheat. They'll cheat anyone. It's not the government. They'll cheat anybody. But you have otherwise upstanding people. Like, why would they cheat the government? Why do they think that's okay? Like, we all know there are laws that govern our country. So where does that come from? So my father has told me he doesn't think it's because all of them are so evil and corrupt and terrible. It's because they're still living in shtetl mentality. What was the shtetl mentality? You ever heard the stories of the pirates? Right? Nobody knows what I'm talking about? They tell stories about, you know, there was a guy in the shtetl who was so horrible, who used to oppress us, and we had to pay our way out of it, and we had to make negotiations, and we had to save our lives, and we had to hide, and we had to this. That's the way it once was. And unfortunately, in some communities, it's still that way. But for those of us who are blessed to live here, in the free world, or in Eretz Yisrael, which is living by a democratic set of laws, when you have a situation like that, it's a very different kind of reality. You're not living with a non-Jew next door to you on the block in fear that maybe he's going to kill you. That's not the reality we live with. And everything changes. As a result of that, we're not trying to pay our way out of things anymore. We don't need to do that. We're not talking about trying to get around the system because the system is so corrupt. We're talking about a country. Do you agree with all of its policies? No. That's okay. You don't have to. It's a free country. And we have so many religious freedoms, and we have to be grateful. Medina Shel Chesed, that's what Moshe called America. But as a result of that, we have to realize that the circumstances have changed as well. To cheat the government today is not acceptable by any means. Maybe it was when you lived in Russia and it was a corrupt government and everything was upside down and you were never dealing with honest people. So there was no other way to live as Jews, to survive, other than to do that. But that's not the reality today. And I think the same is the explanation of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach in understanding what is it that our world represents today that's different about what was. The difference is when they lived in a shtetl and you had only Jews living together and they all cared for each other because there was no one else in the world who would ever bother to care for them. They were left alone and abandoned. Nobody was willing to think about them for a moment. In a situation like that, yes, that's very different than what we have today. And therefore, says Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, the same way today that a non-Jew will go to a Jewish doctor because the Jewish doctor has a great expertise in a certain area of medicine, it goes in the opposite direction as well. We're not afraid to go to a non-Jewish doctor and say, oh, maybe he's going to kill me while I'm on the operating table. I mean, it's not. It may unfortunately happen that somebody dies on the operating table, but it's not because the doctor hates the patient. It's not because the doctor hates Jews. Now, don't get me wrong. Maybe it has happened sometime in the history of the United States that a doctor hated a patient. I don't know. Someone's going to call me out on that, and that's not my point. The point is that for the most part, we use the services of the non-Jewish medical professionals, and they use our services as well. So what's going to happen? What's going to happen if I say that I'm not willing to treat a non-Jew who shows up because it's Shabbos? You know what's going to happen? The next time that we have a need with a member of the Jewish community who needs the expertise of a different medical professional, they're going to say the same. You're not willing to help us and save our lives? You think we're going to help you to save your community's lives? This wouldn't make sense. It's just not the reality that we live with today. That and beyond the fact that we live in such a global community where if one thing like this would happen here, it would go around the world within seconds, within minutes. And it would cause problems for Jews all over the world. So this is not just an issue, Mishum Eva. It's not like, oh, you know what's going to be. This is an issue of actual pikuach nefesh for our own communities. And therefore, the entire set of circumstances changes, and nothing is at all the same as what's described in the Gemara. I remember I asked Rav Asher Weiss a couple of years ago, there was a protest somewhere in Yerushalayim in one of the very extreme neighborhoods. I forgot what was going on. They were protesting against the Israeli government for something, whatever the issue happened to have been. And I was so dismayed by what I saw. There was a picture that I saw of all the children coming out to a protest with yellow stars on their lapels to invoke the image of the Holocaust and say, look, the Israeli government is so wicked, it's so evil, it's so horrible, that we're going to evoke that memory of the Holocaust to remind ourselves of how terrible this is. So I was so offended. I'm not even a child of Holocaust survivors or a grandchild of Holocaust survivors, but the Holocaust is so much a part of our identity. And I just said, how could it possibly be that an Orthodox Jew, let alone, forget Orthodox, any Jew living in today's society is willing to take the Holocaust as any kind of similarity to the situation that we're facing today? You don't like the Israeli government? Okay. You think the Israeli government has corrupt laws? Fine. You think the Israeli government is not leading itself based on the rules of the Torah? Also fine. Go protest. Do what you have to do. Civil disobedience. You're going to wear a yellow star and say that in any way they're similar to the Holocaust? To the Nazis? I couldn't get over it. So I called Rav Asher Weiss and I asked him, what is this? Like, how do I understand? I don't like to believe that people are so evil, they're so... this is so evil. How can it be? And he said to me, he said, look, I'm not excusing the behavior. It's horrible. But he said, you have to understand in the world that these people live in. They don't have the internet. They know nothing about global communication. So they went out, they made a protest in the middle of the street. And again, he's not excusing it, but he's saying, just understand why it's so different to someone like you than it is to someone like them. You're both Orthodox, but you're living in a very different set of circumstances. So they're living in a world where they don't know about social media. They don't understand the moment they go out into the street with something like that, it's going to be all over the world within minutes. And the tragic consequences of doing such a thing are something that we can't even measure, we can't even imagine. And yet, they just can't understand it, they can't appreciate it, because they don't understand how global networking works. For us, this is beyond insane. Forgetting about the act itself, the repercussions of what this is going to do to the world, the image that you're conjuring up for people all over the place is something that is so unacceptable. So again, you have to understand the situation that somebody's in before really getting down to understand why it is that they're doing what it is that they're doing. So the situation that we're faced with today is so different than the set of circumstances that were in the times of the Gemara or in the times of the Shulchan Aruch as well. And that is why Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach is very comfortable saying that he feels that this is something that we absolutely should do. Which is why, I'm going to take your question in a minute, which is why Rav Moshe Feinstein writes in a tshuva in Aruch Chaim Chelek Dalet as well, that if somebody is in a city where it's Rov B'nei Ha'ir Avodas Kochavim, where you have most of the inhabitants of the town are non-Jews, Umi'uta Yisrael, I'm trying to think, would it be easier if we pulled it up on here next time? Anybody know how to do that? Yeah. Can anyone sign in, or it's only teachers? All right, we'll try it after class. Because I see everyone's opening and closing, moving, so I'm sorry. But Rav Moshe says, what if I live in a community where it's Rubam Ovdei Kochavim Umiyutan Yisrael? Says Rav Moshe, you have to make sure, he says, that if you're a doctor on call, you're going to make sure that your day on call is not going to be Shabbos. Because what's the likelihood that you're actually going to tend to a Jewish patient on Shabbos? However, he says, if it turns out that I'm called to the hospital, that I need to go on a shift, that I need to give my services as a medical professional for whatever reason, obviously a doctor doesn't work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. So he has days where he's able to choose to be on or to be off. Says Rav Moshe, you should choose Shabbos as your day off, because it's not appropriate to go into the hospital and save lives when it will include doing malacha that is unnecessary if you can have other people doing it. However, says Rav Moshe, if I end up in the hospital for whatever reason, and I'm called upon to use my services, writes Rav Moshe, Oshkeshu kvar rofe kavua, she'af ha-misrat shelo sargim b'Shabbos, even though my office is closed on Shabbos, but everybody knows if an emergency comes up, they call me from the hospital. I'm the head of the ICU. What are you going to do? If an emergency comes up, they need to talk to me. I'm first going to ask, oh, 1 second, are you calling that a Jew or a non-Jew? Says Rav Moshe, that's impossible. You can't do such a thing. Says Rav Moshe, of course, even if it entails chilul Shabbos de'oraisa, even if it entails driving in your car, doing a full-fledged malacha, that would be something that we would absolutely permit on Shabbos, and it would not be a problem at all, because he says this would lead to such terrible things. Now, you had a question. Yeah. Right. So that's a very excellent question. So you're saying that the takeaway here at the end of the day is that, yes, we would save a life on Shabbos, whether it's a Jew or a non-Jew. However, it almost seems like the only reason we're doing it is Mishaneva, which really is the primary factor and consideration, or because it's Pikuach Nefesh to a Jew. It seems that that is the bottom line. Now, I have to say, I identify with your question, and I think it's a very strong one. But it seems from the sources that that is the bottom line, which... Again, the bottom line halacha is the same, which is that we save a life indiscriminately. We're going to do whatever we can to save a life, and it's important for us to do that. But I think the reasoning behind it is very correct. Like you're saying, it's something that we should think about. Something that we should think about. Yeah. Other question? Okay, so now I think we get to what I believe is an even more uncomfortable conversation, and that is forgetting about a non-Jew right now. We just discussed it. The Gemara spoke about it, Shulchan Aruch, Mishnah Brura, but then everything changed in the last 100 years. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach took this and flipped it on its head and said, everything's different today. Okay. What about when we're dealing with someone who is a chiloni, somebody who's completely irreligious? Would there be any discrimination, any difference between caring for one who is Torah observant and one who is not? Now, I would say every Jew is important for us to look after. Well, if you're following that logic, I would say every non-Jew is also important for us to look after. We have to make sure that we care for other people's lives, so why should there be a difference at all? So we have to look at the Gemara, we have to look in the sources here. Let's read the Rambam, and I ask you again, hang on till the end of the sentence, because this is not the bottom line, but the Rambam is important for us to look at. The Rambam tells us, Me'achar shenisparsim shehu kofer b'Torah shebal peh. If you know that there's somebody who is completely kofer b'Torah shebal peh, says the Rambam, somebody who does not believe at all, the Rambam says very strong words, Maridin osof lo malin. You know what? Lower him into a pit and just keep him there. That's the way the Rambam says. Bamed var mamurim. When is this the case? The Rambam says it's only if he denies this, if he denies that, if he doesn't keep this, doesn't keep that. Okay. Then the Rambam continues. What if you have somebody who's just a child of one of these families? It's not that that person made an ideological decision on their own that this is what I want to do, but rather, the person said, I was born into this family, what can I do? I don't know any better, I wasn't sent to a school where they taught me this. In a situation like that, you were born into one of those families and you didn't have an education and you don't know any differently. Hareu ketinok shenishba b'neyam b'galu, says the Rambam, you cannot fault such a person. You cannot say that that person, oh, they're not religious, they're not, what do you mean they're not, how are they supposed to know any differently? How should they know any differently? So I asked my father once, what do you mean, we live in a world of global communication, as we said. People heard about Shabbos. People know, especially if you live in Israel, people know that the observant community in Israel keeps Shabbos. So how can you say today, like the Rambam says, Tinuk Shenishba? And it's like, you know what the Tinuk Shenishba, what that phrase actually means? Tinuk Shenishba means when you have a child who is captured by the enemy and grew up in enemy territory, an enemy family, and they don't know any better. So that's the Rambam's borrowed term for what it means when we have somebody who grew up without a background, without an education. Okay? So I said to my father today, when you have a situation where everybody knows about Shabbos, we're all familiar, we all read the newspaper, we've seen every so often they have an article about it, So we said, yeah, that's true. They all know about it, but there's still a kiddush lishma. Why? Because some people who grow up in that way assume that those people who observe Shabbos are just fanatics. They don't think that that's an underpinning of what it means to be an Orthodox Jew. They don't understand that that's what it means to be a person who really believes in God. They think the extreme Jews do that. We're the mainstream. They say we're the mainstream. We live life in moderation. And therefore, it's still a Tinoch Shemishma because they're not aware of the fact that they, that our observance of Shabbos is something that should be taken upon by them. So that's what the Rambam says. The Radbaz, one of the great Gedolim in the early 1500s, takes issue with this. Rambam, he discusses it. So here's the question. If the Rambam's words are to be taken literally, so what do you do? What do you do with the situation we have today? Let's look at a Chazon Ish, which has become a very famous Chazon Ish and a very important Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was one of the greatest Gedolim of our generation. He passed away in 1953. He moved from Vilna to Bnei Brak before the Holocaust. And the Chazon Ish basically was responsible for so much of Torah Jewry in Israel post-Holocaust because of his leadership. So the Chazon Ish was faced with the following issue. Came to Israel, and there were Chilonim everywhere. So what is the status of the Chilonim in Israel? Writes the Chazon Ish as follows, and it's so important to know his words. Osan she'avosav perishu midarkei hatzibur. If you have somebody whose parents are totally unaffiliated, and as a result of that, the children grew up without a Torah background, without education, writes the Chazon Ish unequivocally, Dino ki Yisrael l'chol davar. He is a card-counting member of the Jewish people. We hold nothing against that person. They need to have equal treatment to everyone else, not only with regard to Shabbos, but with every aspect of our lives, says the Chazon Ish. Vinami sarach limud shir yidiyaso ilo chashad meizit. The Chazon Ish then continues and he says, Ulagabe din moridim. Aye, the Rambam says, if you have somebody of this nature, moridim olamalim, we have a very firm approach against such a person, says the Chazon Ish. No, no, no. Lo nemar din ze ela bizman shashgachasa yizbarach giluya. The only time the din moridim olamalim applies is when you have an individual that's living at a time where it says the Chazon Ish, Hashgachaso Yizbarach Geluya. The presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is so obviously felt by everyone in the world. But says the Chazon Ish, Kamo Bizman Shah Yunisim Mitsuyim Umeshamish Baskol, Vitzadike Ador Tachas Hashgacha Pratis Hanira Le'en Kol, Va'akofrim Oz Hayu Benezilus, Miyuchedes Vahatayas Hayetzel Le'taybus Vahefkerus. This is talking about like at a time of the Beis Hamikdash. When you have such clear and obvious Gilui Shechina, you have an opportunity to relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on such a profound level. And then a person chooses at that time to reject him, that's where the Rambam says, Moridin Rulamal. But that's very specific to that time and place. However, he says, when we live at a time, Avo Bizman HaHelen, when we live at a time, what he refers to as Helen, which means, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hidden. And it's exactly what the Pasuk says in Sefer Devarim. Va'anofi haster aster panaya. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has hidden His face from us. Shenichrusa ha'emunah min dalas ha'am. Let's be honest. Most Jews in the world are not observant. It's an unfortunate reality. But it's the truth. Most Jews in the world are not observant. And therefore, he says, "Ein b'maseh horada geder hapirza ela hosafas hapirza." Chazon Ish writes so importantly. What's the reason why the Rambam said we take such a strong stance when you have someone who takes upon themselves this kind of life? Why do we say moridim olamalim? Why do we say don't say that person's life? Why is that? Says the Rambam. I'm sorry. Explains the Chazon Ish because it's supposed to be ligdor hapirza. You had a religious community. You had everybody doing one thing. You have one member of the community who decides to venture off, do their own thing, give it all up. says the Rambam, we need to take a very strong stand on that person that everyone should understand, this is unacceptable. That's an unacceptable choice for anyone else to be making. And that's why we take a hardline approach on that individual. However, writes the Chazon Ish, imagine if we were to do that today. If you come across somebody who's unaffiliated and you say, you know, the Rambam says, we're reading a little Says the Chazon Ish, do you think you're helping Judaism by doing that? Or you're pushing people further away? Are you being Goda the Pirza? Are you actually fixing a problem? Or he says, are you doing Hosafas HaPirza? Are you making the problem even worse? Why? Because what is the message, the takeaway that people are going to make from what they see? They're going to say, look at these people. Look at these people. This is exactly why we want to have nothing to do with them. Because this is how they behave, this is how they react. Says the Chazon Ish. And that's why it's important that we shift perspective today and we think about this all very, very differently. Says the Chazon Ish, the bottom line of every decision that we make as a Jew needs to be lesakein. We're trying to make the world better. We're trying to make the community better. We're trying to elevate people. This whole idea that the Rambam discusses from the Gemara is something that is irrelevant today, because it's not going to make the world better by doing this. It's not going to make our community any stronger by doing it. To the contrary, it's going to make things worse. And it's not going to help us, it's only going to hurt us. And therefore he says, Aleinu lahachziram ba'avoso sa'ava ulahamidam b'keren ora b'mashi adenu magas. And therefore he says that we should do whatever it takes to be Mechal Shabbos. We should do whatever it takes to make sure that we do everything to make these people feel they are part of the community, they are embraced by the community, they are loved by the community, they get the same treatment as every other member of the immediate community has. And whatever the Rambam says is not relevant to the set of circumstances that we are facing today. This is not only something that the Chazon Ish said, it's something that the Chafetz Chaim said before him as well. It's something that Rav Moshe Feinstein writes about also in the Yigras Moshe. It's actually a fascinating discussion. What is the halacha when you have a situation when, let's say, I'm a doctor and I have to go on call and I have every ability to say, well, Shabbos is my day off. So as we mentioned, if I'm able to do that, great. If I'm unable to do that, okay. So the Achronim say, you do what you have to do. But let's say one of the other doctors in my practice is a chiloni, and he has no problem working on Shabbos. So what do I do in a situation like that? If I'm going to switch out of the shift, I'm just making another Jew do malacha on Shabbos.
So what do you say? What should I do? So this is actually a machlokas between Rav Shlomo Zalman Erbach and Rav Moshe Feinstein. What should I do in such a situation? What's the question? On the one hand, you say, how could I switch out of my problem that I'm faced with on Shabbos of doing malacha, potentially, when the alternative is to make another Jew do malacha? What right do I have to put someone else in that situation? That's Lifnei Iver. Why is his Shabbos worse than my Shabbos? Why does he have less of a right than I have to keep Shabbos? So some argue, you're not allowed to do that. Others say, what do you mean? Imagine what's going to happen. He's a chiloni. So if he's home for Shabbos, what's he going to be doing? He'll be driving to the movies. He'll be doing all kinds of things. I'm going to save him from Chilul Shabbos by sending him to the hospital. Why? Because then, everything he does on Shabbos is Pikuach Nefesh. So all the activities he's involved with are wonderful. So that's not Lifnei Iver. That's enhancing his Shabbos. That's making sure that everything he does on Shabbos is going to be done beheter. So maybe that's the preferred choice. On the other hand, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach argues, maybe you'll say, the only time I have an allowance to do pikuach nefesh activities on Shabbos are only if I'm faced with a situation where I actually know that I'm doing something l'shem pikuach nefesh. But if you have somebody who's just going along with the flow and not thinking about it at all, and not realizing that this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me, is that really saving that person? So again, a fascinating discussion, but I think it's very relevant. It comes up all the time. The bottom line of both of these questions about saving lives on Shabbos, certainly the Achronim say, if we're dealing with a situation like we are all faced with today, where we know that this is something that is so important for us to be completely equal and transparent about. If we have medical expertise and we're able to save someone's life, it doesn't matter who the person is, it doesn't matter where we find ourselves, it doesn't matter whether I'm on call or I'm not on call. If I'm called upon to do this, if there's an expectation that I'm going to help, I need to jump in immediately and do whatever needs to be done. Even though it's contrary to what the Gemara seems to say, and the Rambam, and the Shulchan Aruch, but we have great poskim in our generation who have taken it upon themselves to explain why those set of circumstances no longer apply, and why the halacha needed to be revisited. And I find this to be the most exciting part of halacha, that in every generation, we always need to look at the same questions that came up, but reevaluate and understand, is this the same set of circumstances as it once was? So you say to yourself, well, isn't that Reform or Conservative Judaism? Yeah, circumstances change, so let's change everything, right? So how does this work? It's a very good question. What's important is that every time we're faced with a set of circumstances, we have to look at it and evaluate what would our parents, traditional people, have done if they were faced with this set of circumstances. Following exactly what they did is not always the right way to go, because if they would be alive today, maybe they would do differently. So the Chazon Ish and Moshe Feinstein are not saying, let's change everything, because we're revisionists, because we decided that halacha needs to change, because we need to modify things. No. What they're saying is that if Moshe Rabbeinu was alive today, in our set of circumstances, if the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch were here today, this is what they would tell us to do. They themselves would tell us to behave in this fashion. My father always gives the example. He said, what happened? Yitzhak, what do we know about Yitzhak Avinu? Basically nothing. What does the Torah tell us about Yitzhak? Avraham Avinu, we have a whole lot about him. Yaakov, we have a lot about him. Yitzhak, very little. All we know about Yitzhak is, it seems that he followed in the footsteps of his father, did everything he was supposed to do. That's the story of Yitzhak Avinu, in a nutshell. Obviously, Akedas Yitzhak was a very important moment in his life. So what happens? Yitzhak is faced with a terrible situation in his life, where there's a famine, Vayira v'aretz. What does Yitzhak do? What does he do? He looks back in the family chronicles to see, what did my father do when there was a famine? Let me follow the family tradition. Makes sense. It's what Orthodox Jews are supposed to do. Look back in the books and see, what did our parents do? So he looks back, he's flipping through, he says, oh, my father, Avraham Avinu, once had the same situation, where he was stuck by a famine, he didn't know what to do. So what did he do? He goes to Mitzrayim. I'm going to do the same thing. Yitzchak packs up his bags, he says, I'm following exactly in the tradition of my father. I'm going to go down to Egypt, go down to Mitzrayim, I'm going to leave Eretz Yisrael, because there's a famine. And as he's on his way out, HaKadosh Baruch Hu appears to him and he says, no, no, no. You're not allowed to leave the land of Israel. Yitzchak turns back and he says, what are you talking about? That's what my father did. I'm just following the Masorah. I'm following the tradition. I'm doing exactly what my father did. And the answer is no. Because your set of circumstances is different. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to him, Shchon ba'aretz hazos. You need to stay here. Why? Because you, after the Akedah, you became a carbon. You became sanctified. You became holy. Your father didn't have that status. If your father would have had the same circumstances as you, he would have stayed here also. So the answer is not always, let's look at our father and see what he did, and then do the same. The answer is, we have to look, how would our parents or grandparents or great-grandparents have reacted to the set of circumstances that we are now faced with? And that is why halacha is such a dynamic process. Because in every generation, the great leaders need to look at everything and figure out, how would our ancestors have approached this issue that we're now confronted with? What would they have done? What would their approach have been? What would their reaction and response have been? And that's what's very exciting and very important for all of us to understand, not only with regard to this issue in particular, but really it's something that goes far beyond to so many other areas of halacha as well, and it's the way we need to practice as Orthodox Jews. So